The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai. Now offering 5 years free servicing on every new 142 Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the programme, there's a lot of coverage on foreign stories today. And there's a lot of attention, not just on the actuality of the stories, but on the individual, that is Mr. Putin. Now, the Sunday Times has in the UK has a story, Strip Russia of the World Cup, that was Nick Clegg. Sunday Telegraph front page, Putin facing multi-million pound legal action over alleged role. That's what you were just talking about there. The Observer, yes, Britain can afford to defy Tsar Vladimir Putin. Sunday Mirror Opinion accuses David Cameron of cozying up to Russian oligarchs in return for donations. The Daily Star Sunday, British football clubs fear sanctions aimed at Russia could affect their sponsorship deals. It's money, 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 I suppose, on these things. The Independent on Russia reports Russians have threatened that if sanctions are extended, international cooperation over weapons of mass destruction, etc., will be hit. Putin stays on offence in Ukraine. And that was from AP. And we have been joined in studio now also by Simon McKeever, CEO of Irish Exporters Association, and we'll be talking to Tim Stanley, the Telegraph and historian, shortly. And first of all, I suppose the whole business of sanctions, I presume, is something that you would have a particular interest in. But we personalise this into Putin himself, don't we?
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
I suppose we do, and I don't particularly want to get overly into the politics of it, but it's a big issue for Ireland. I mean, Russia is a reasonably important market for us. It's a developing market. It's one of the BRICS, so it's one with a very rapidly expanding middle class that buy actually a lot of food from us and a lot of agricultural products. And from Ireland's point of view, that's the market that would probably be hit most by this.
Right, let me go to Tim Stanley, if I may. Tim, good afternoon to you.
Hello, good afternoon.
And thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. I referred yesterday on the programme to Newsweek having a story on the private life of Mr. Putin. And then you get people comparing, well, calling him the Tsar and comparing him to Hitler. You've been looking at him and you have been writing about him. You take us on a guided tour of the man himself.
I think it's always ridiculous, first of all, to compare anyone to Hitler. But it is interesting that after people have been in power for a very long time, they start to develop a certain psychological profile. And the Newsweek article, which I really do recommend, gives a very good profile of Putin that is very familiar to those who study power. So, for example, he lives in isolation outside of the Kremlin. He actually has very little to do with the bureaucracy. He's given a nickname like the Tsar. He appears to have a certain degree of contempt for the people around him and even for the Russian political system. He gets up very late in the day, which is a very common thing.
That struck me as extraordinary.
It is. And yet, and this is also very interesting, despite the fact that he gets up late in the day and seems to spend a lot of time pontificating, he also said that he regards himself as the most hard-working Russian leader since Stalin. So you have, on the one hand, a man who is so powerful that he doesn't really have to do the job anymore in the way he may have had to have done 10 years ago in the 9-to-5 sense. And on the other hand, is so certain of how important he is to Russia that he's convinced he's the only man holding it together. And that is typically the most important aspect of the authoritarian profile, is the conviction that the country literally couldn't function without you. And when you reach that point where someone comes to believe that, then they regard it as their mission from destiny to stay in power. And that's when it becomes very difficult to dislodge them.
That'd be like Mr. Mugabe, say.
Exactly, yes, yes. Mm.
In terms of self-interest, people were talking about extending the sanctions and all of that. No matter what we do on that, whoever gets sanctioned, whoever imposes sanctions, is going to suffer themselves. Do you think there's the will in England to do that?
I think actually there is. And there is surprisingly among our politicians too, and I'm pleased to see that. The problem is that the current EU package does hurt us disproportionately to a lot of other people. So, for example, oil and gas are not covered in the sanctions package. Germany happens to get about a third of its oil and gas from Russia. But, of course, access to capital markets, which the London City is very good at, will be affected by the sanctions. But despite all of that, I think if anyone's going to be making the case for this, it's Britain. And we've been reminded in this whole crisis of how much Britain and America's outlook on foreign policy and on dealing with Russia is very different from the European Union's. The Americans have been implying sanctions from day one. And I think the British would be in favor of that if they were a little more proportionate across the whole of the EU, whereas there just seems to be a great resistance to it in the rest of the EU.
One of the things, a point was made by a guest on the programme a couple of weeks ago, that when the wall came down, and compared it to what had happened after the Second World War, where there was the Marshall Plan and all that. But when the wall came down and people said, well, there you go, communism was a disaster. Mind you, since then, we know capitalism, not brilliant either. But that's another day's story. And that, you know, by Europe cozying up to Ukraine and by expanding NATO and all of that, it was kind of like rubbing the Russians in general, but most particularly Vladimir Putin's nose in it. And that he also has to, as it were, defend Russian pride and dignity.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, actually, the end of the Cold War was good for the vast majority of people who are free from communism, partly for democratic reasons, but also places like Poland, the Czech Republic, have economically flourished and done very, very well. The Baltic states, too. However, from a Russian perspective, they didn't see it coming. They were devastated when it happened. And in the 1990s, living standards, formerly propped up by the state, just absolutely collapsed. And as far as they were concerned, their country was raped by capitalists.
Putin
does represent someone trying to bring back that sense of honour and dignity to the Russian people.
And with it, a degree of economic comfort at this point?
Yes, I think so. I mean, what you've got to understand, every Russian I ever speak to says, we've got to grasp about Putin is he turned the power back on. He paid people's wages and people got their pensions. He has brought an economic stability that wasn't there in the Yeltsin years. The problem is that he's come to rely far too much upon mineral exports. The country's economy is in a very rough state. It'll get even worse with these sanctions. Its birth rate is declining. It has many structural and demographic crises facing it. But there is still a feeling that he has kept it together and restored the state's ability to get things done. And that's what really collapsed in the early 90s.
And say his status, I see since the annexation of Crimea, that his popularity has gone up. And yeah, he has moved around in various other states, and he has used that argument that was used before. I see Colin McCarthy writing about it today, by the way, here, of associating Russia, you know, with Russian speakers and Russian culture in other countries. He's done it kind of quite successfully, and nobody has really said, sorry, Mr. Putin, you can't be doing that.
Yeah, I think to go back to our earlier conversation about which dictator is he most like, he's not Hitler. He's closer to Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia in the 1990s. Slobodan Milosevic was in charge of the Yugoslav Republic when it broke up. He suddenly found himself in charge of a disintegrating multi-ethnic empire. And so what he tried to do was to turn Serbia into the ethnic hegemony within the region. He wanted to dominate all the lesser people by the Serbs. And that's what's happening in Russia. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, so many Russians found themselves living in foreign countries. And what Putin is trying to do is reassert Russian dominance within the region. In some cases, carving bits of those countries off, like in Ukraine. In other places, simply reducing sovereign states' ability to govern themselves. So you're seeing it's not quite perhaps so much going back to the USSR. It might be closer, actually, to going back to the old Russian Empire.
There you go. Anyway, I know that you recommended that Newsweek article yourself, and we would recommend it to people. It was just so really interesting. Even the way he humiliates, you know, which is no surprise, I suppose, his own ministers are visiting dignitaries by watching them on CCTV as he leaves them wait for 2 hours or whatever for a meeting, all those kind of things. But anyway, listen, can I say thank you very much indeed for talking to us. And that was Tim Stanley of The Telegraph, and historian, and thank you very much indeed for that.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Well, it was interesting to hear what Tim Stanley was saying there, and about Slobodan Milosevic. And funny enough, Colin McCarthy was writing about that today too, and he was comparing Putin to him as well. Would you go along with it?
Well, I wouldn't disagree, I think, you know, but I wouldn't have the same sort of knowledge as some of the experts. But I would have thought that Putin is attempting to increase the size of his reign over Russia and its satellites, because what's happening in Ukraine is just an extension of what they're doing in other places.
Well, it's also going to increasingly extraordinary lengths to suppress any kind of political opposition or even freedom of expression. I mean, the suppression of freedom of expression in Russia now is quite extraordinary. Anybody who wants to voice dissent, I mean, we keep hearing about how popular Putin is, but there's no opposition to
First
Putin that's allowed to
emerge. First thing he does in the morning after he's had been
read
to the gym.
Reads the tabloids. And he needs cottage cheese, I heard you.
Yeah. he reads all coverage. It's all newspaper. And before he gets to matters of state, looks at all kind of coverage. And if people don't, and I mean, I've interviewed so many people who were thrown out for criticising them for corruption and all that. But can I come back to you, David? First of all, you just mentioned to me that you think he's losing it.
Yeah, his popularity has gone up predictably because Russians are nationalistic and paranoid. But objectively, he's losing his touch. He was taken by surprise by the Ukrainian crisis, which the Europeans were. The Europeans were stirring up trouble for all sorts of reasons in Ukraine. And that seems to have come as a surprise to Russians. Like, the Crimean crisis wasn't something that Putin wanted. It was thrust upon him. And you can't imagine an earlier Putin making those mistakes. Like, in 2000, he was the KGB officer of Leningrad.
Yeah.
He was the man in control. If he had had, say, a militia or terrorists in Ukraine, you could be sure there'd be FSB officers keeping an eye on them, choosing their targets, making sure they didn't step out of line. How did this crisis happen? They had these powerful weapons. And they used them to attack a civilian aircraft, which is almost certainly a complete mistake.
That's the point. It seems that it was almost certainly a complete mistake.
So the Russians have been caught out. They've been caught red-handed. It wasn't authorised by the Kremlin. They didn't launch it from Russian territory, but they did provide the weapons. Mm-hmm. And now they're humiliated, and now they need some slack. You know, you can't back Putin into a corner. It's completely predictable that he would react repressively. It's completely predictable that they would back the Russian Orthodox, Russian-speaking people in the east of the Ukraine, which has been Russian-dominated for 500 years. What we want is a solution to this. I think there's a good chance Putin won't survive. And I think his successor is someone close to him.
Apparently there's only one person that kind of can publicly criticise him. I really want to know about oil supplies and gas supplies and all of that. But just, do you think NATO, Colm, coming back to you, was and Europe, was unreasonable and insensitive in getting closer and closer and closer to the Russian borders?
Well, I think what has transpired would give an indication of that, but it's a bit like, you know, realizing that after the fact is done. And it's easy to say that. But certainly, I think for a lot of people, it might have been felt that, you know, give them, let them have Crimea, but if they go into the sovereign territory of Ukraine, for whatever reason, to protect the citizens, I mean, it's a bit like the Bosnian Serbs. They wanted to carve out their own territory.
Yeah.
You know, the answer is, if you want to be part of Belgrade, then go to Belgrade. If you want to be part of Russia, then cross and you know, emigrate to Russia. But they don't look upon it from that point of view. It's at the stage now where there's no appetite for a conflict, really, from the West. NATO just will, I'd say NATO is very relieved that Ukraine is not a member of NATO. Because an attack on NATO is an attack on all.
Yeah.
And I think there's a certain amount of relief behind the scenes that it isn't. So there's no appetite for a conflict. Therefore, I think to a degree, Putin can more or less do what he wants.
You figure.
And there's the feeling that he is supporting a large majority of people in this part of Ukraine that want to be part of Russia.
Can I come back to you, David, on a gallop around the world? And indeed, of course, it's a matter that would be of interest to you too, to all of us, actually, is we get our gas at the end of a very, very, very long line. I mean, you're in the oil world and you're in the energy world and all of that. How much clout can we exercise through sanctions without fierce pain in this part of the world?
We have no leverage. We can do tokenism like was done on Putin's cronies recently. This was based on the Mugabe model. You stop the girlfriends or wives of Mugabe's ministers shopping in Harrods, which reads well in the Western papers, but doesn't have a big impact, frankly, in these regimes. Sanctions almost never work, even when they're imposed by large blocs on small countries. And they never work when they're imposed on people who have strength by people who have less strength. We require 32% of our supplies to come from Russia. We made an effort to...
Ireland now.
Europe.
Oh, Europe, yeah.
Ireland's an even worse situation. Ireland is 95% import dependent. And everyone says, we get it from the Scots. But what people don't realise is that Britain imports 62% of its gas now. So we're right at the end of this very long chain. Mm-hmm. And we've worsened the situation by public policy, by delaying the development of our own indigenous gas at Corrib, and by preventing an American company, Hess, from bringing in liquefied natural gas. So Ireland's one of those examples where public policy and general political sentiments actually worsen our import dependence.
Who have we banned from being?
We haven't technically banned it. What they've done is they're making it uneconomic to bring in liquefied natural gas by forcing the developers of the LNG to effectively subsidise their competitors. So even though they bring in gas or want to bring in gas into the Shannon Estuary, they have to pay Bord Gáis to import gas to compete with them in the Irish market, which makes it uneconomic. In Corrib, it's not deliberate government policy, but a project that could have been developed in 6 or 7 years has taken 19 years.
Yeah, because we're a democracy.
Because we don't have proper planning laws and because people defer to articulate interest groups rather than seeking the national interest.
I think it's called democracy. You know, you are allowed to object and you are allowed to go to a board planola and you are allowed to do all those things in a democracy. Frustration, though, maybe for people in the business, but I presume that pragmatism also works and that it will go ahead full speed ahead now.
Oh, Corrib will be in production next year. So that will about supply half of Irish gas. And for the first time, there's major exploration now again in the Irish offshore. Despite the best efforts of the government to stymie it by creating confusion over the fiscal terms. So there will be exploration, there will be gas discoveries.
And hasn't Tony O'Reilly's company had a find of, what was it, oil?
Well, in 1973, Esso had a discovery in Barry Row, which is sought to be brought into production by Tony O'Reilly's company, Providence.
Yeah.
And they probably will get it into production, but it's been a long and difficult road.
I know that.
That's oil.
I know that. I know because your colleague was in the day that was in the papers and he was delighted for them because they had stuck at it for so long to do it. So what do you think will happen? I mean, I was listening to a Dutch representative on the radio the other day and apparently I thought Germany did the maximum, per capita within Europe of business with Russia. They said no, it was the Dutch, but that the Dutch are so angry about what happened on the Malaysian air flight that they will take a hit. How do you see this panning out for us?
Well, first of all, in the Dutch is the biggest trading relationship with Russia over there. And it's not just the oil and gas that they buy and what they sell. I think they're the second biggest, Russia's the second biggest markets for their flowers. But actually there's a massive amount of physical trade goes through the port of Rotterdam, which gets buried in the figures as well. And 70 billion worth of Russian trade goes through there. I think from our point of view, We're a small voice in all of this, that the negotiations are being done by the EU and it's been done at that table, and we feed into that piece. So, I mean, it seems to me like we are going to go down the road of these sanctions on defence, on finance. Nobody's going to touch Gazprom because they'd be terrified that the tap might get turned off.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Gazprom actually employs about 1,000 people in the UK and they have a whole retail arm over there. So there's an awful lot of different things going on. I think that we probably will go down this road. I think that the sanctions that will be levelled on Russia will cause a number of things. I think from our point of view, even though we don't, I suppose, get our gas from Russia, there is still a limited supply of that. I think we get it from Norway is what it says on the Bord Gáis website. But then there's suddenly an increased demand for gas if the Russians turn off the tap. And where does everybody else get it? So the cost of gas will go up, which will make the cost of doing business in Ireland a hell of a lot more, which will directly impact our competitiveness. Mm. So that will make business in Ireland more uncompetitive against the rest of the world. So it's a big issue for us. The other thing, the other impact it will have on is on the Russian economy directly. So they hiked interest rates by 0.5%, I think, on Friday last week. The economy looks like it's about to go into recession. So there'll be less stuff bought from Europe. I mean, I think Russia is Europe's third biggest trading partner. Mm. And most countries are in a trade deficit. We're only one of six that actually have a trade surplus with Russia.
Yeah, and a lot of European countries are actually trading a lot with Russia. So it's not just the Netherlands. The Netherlands, if you take away the numbers for the ports and, you know, the way that they have Russia done, then actually Germany would be trading more with Russia than the Netherlands, if you exclude just the port bit, because then it's the figure for Germany is 60 billion. So it's enormous. And if you take the port away, it's 51 billion for the Netherlands. So the Netherlands are then number two or something. And then we have France and Italy and the UK. All three also very important. The UK, I think, it's around 15 billion. Mm. So they are important trading partner of Russia. And if we have sanctions, we need to be very careful in the West that we don't also, because politically, yes, that's on one level. We need to do something. And somebody like Putin, you know, needs to be put sort of in his, you know, the way little territory and be told, look, you can't do everything. But we need to be careful that, because we are in a fragile recovery in Europe, that we do not now endanger that, because Germany already was saying if we now, if certain sanctions are put in place, then up to 350,000 jobs could be in danger in Germany alone. And that is a real danger in Europe, that in this very fragile state we're all in, like France.
So what do you do if about all these people that were blown out of the sky?
How do you mean all these people blown out of the sky? You mean this aircraft that it came down? That needs to be condemned, of course. But you see, you need to be careful with what type of sanctions you do, because also, you see, who do you target with your sanctions? Because the normal Russian person on the street, you know, the way who's trying to make ends meet and is on a very little pension and has it difficult and can hardly heat their room in winter, they will get, you know, they were hit by certain sanctions, and you do not want to hit them. So you see, you have to see an economic sanction you put will sort of spread blanket misery and probably will not necessarily even get to the people it's trying to target. And that's the problem.
Just, I mean, a couple of weeks ago in St. Petersburg, President Putin made a speech calling on the Russian economy to be more inward focused and to ban food imports, and that it should become more self-sufficient. You've already got a Russian ban on EU pig and pig meat imports, and there was a load of inspectors over here looking at 12 plants here. So there's already 12 plants here in the food and drink area who've had their, not, don't say export license, but their ability to be able to trade with Russia revoked on a temporary basis. Now, a temporary basis in other countries is meant 2 years. So, you know, there's a habit of ding-dong going on. So there's a bit of a tit-for-tat that has been going on. I mean, part of some of this is that Ukraine has kind of got caught in between the setup of a Eurasian customs union, which has Belarus, Russia and Kazakhstan in it, and the rest of the EU sitting on the other side. But, you know, I think this could be very serious for Ireland if we go down that road. That's not saying that it's right or wrong, but from a trading point of view.
Never mind. I know, it's pragmatism, isn't it? Never mind the principle. Maybe the court case is the way to go. What do you think will happen, David?
Well, nothing, basically. We have no real serious options. We'll do exactly the same about the 300 people on the flight that we'll do about the 1,000 people in Gaza. We'll condemn it. We won't make any effective moves to prevent its recurrence.
Right. OK, we will leave it there for the moment. I presume something is going to happen, but it can often just be done to make people feel good rather than think through the consequences, and that is the concern. At this stage, I have to earn a few bob, and we will take a break.